This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Catching the Big Fish, Meditation, Consciousness, and Creativity. Written and read by David Lynch. To His Holiness Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Introduction. Ideas are like fish. If you want to catch little fish, you can stay in the shallow water, but if you want to catch the big fish, you've got to go deeper. Down deep, the fish are more powerful and more pure. They're huge and abstract, and they're very beautiful. I look for a certain kind of fish that is important to me, one that can translate to cinema. But there are all kinds of fish swimming down there. There are fish for business, fish for sports. There are fish for everything. Everything, anything that is a thing, comes up from the deepest level. Modern physics calls that level the unified field. The more your consciousness, your awareness, is expanded, the deeper you go toward this source, the bigger the fish you can catch. My 33-year practice of the Transcendental Meditation Program has been central to my work in film and painting and to all areas of my life. For me, it has been the way to dive deeper in search of the big fish. In this book, I want to share some of those experiences with you. The First Dive. He whose happiness is within, whose contentment is within, whose light is all within, that yogi, being one with Brahman, attains eternal freedom in pure consciousness. From the Bhagavad Gita. When I first heard about meditation, I had zero interest in it. I wasn't even curious. It sounded like a waste of time. What got me interested, though, was the phrase, "True happiness lies within." At first, I thought it sounded kind of mean because it doesn't tell you where the within is or how to get there. But still, it had a ring of truth, and I began to think that maybe meditation was a way to go within. I looked into meditation, asked some questions, and started contemplating different forms. At that moment, my sister called and said she had been doing transcendental meditation for 6 months. There was something in her voice, a change, a quality of happiness, and I thought, that's what I want. So in July 1973, I went to the TM Center in Los Angeles and met an instructor, and I liked her. She looked like Doris Day, and she taught me this technique. She gave me a mantra, which is a sound, vibration, thought. You don't meditate on the meaning of it, but it's a very specific sound, vibration, thought. She took me into a little room to have my first meditation. I sat down, closed my eyes, started this mantra, and it was as if I were in an elevator and the cable had been cut. Boom! I fell into bliss, pure bliss, and I was just in there. Then the teacher said, "It's time to come out. It's been 20 minutes. And I said, "It's already been 20 minutes? And she said, "Shh," because other people were meditating. It seemed so familiar, but also so new and powerful. After that, I said the word unique should be reserved for this experience. It takes you to an ocean of pure consciousness, pure knowingness, but it's familiar. It's you. And right away a sense of happiness emerges, not a goofball happiness, but a thick beauty. I have never missed a meditation in 33 years. I meditate once in the morning and again in the afternoon for about 20 minutes each time. Then I go about the business of my day, and I find that the joy of doing increases, intuition increases, the pleasure of life grows, and negativity recedes. Suffocating rubber clown suit. It would be easier to roll up the entire sky into a small cloth than it would be to obtain true happiness without knowing the self. From the Upanishads. When I started meditating, I was filled with anxieties and fears. I felt a sense of depression and anger. I took out this anger on my first wife. After I had been meditating for about 2 weeks, she came to me and said, "What's going on?" I was quiet for a moment, but finally I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "This anger, where did it go?" And I hadn't even realized that it had lifted. I call that depression and anger the suffocating rubber clown suit of negativity. It's suffocating, and that rubber stinks. But once you start meditating and diving within, the clown suit starts to dissolve. You finally realize how putrid was the stink when it starts to go. Then when it dissolves, you have freedom. Anger and depression and sorrow are beautiful things in a story, but they're like poison to the filmmaker or artist. They're like a vice grip on creativity. If you're in that grip, you can hardly get out of bed, much less experience the flow of creativity and ideas. You must have clarity to create. You have to be able to catch ideas. Starting out. I started out just as a regular person growing up in the Northwest. My father was a research scientist for the Department of Agriculture, studying trees. So I was in the woods a lot, and the woods for a child are magical. I lived in what people call small towns. My world was what would be considered about a city block, maybe two blocks. Everything occurred in that space. All the dreaming, all my friends existed in that small world, but to me it seemed so huge and magical. There was plenty of time available to dream and be with friends. I liked to paint and I liked to draw, and I often thought wrongly that when you got to be an adult, you stopped painting and drawing and did something more serious. In the 9th grade, my family moved to Alexandria, Virginia. On the front lawn of my girlfriend's house one night, I met a guy named Toby Keeler. As we were talking, he said his father was a painter. I thought maybe he might have been a house painter, but further talking got me around to the fact that he was a fine artist. This conversation changed my life. I had been somewhat interested in science, but I suddenly knew I wanted to be a painter, and I wanted to live the art life. The art life. In high school, I read Robert Henri's book, The Art Spirit, which prompted the idea of the art life. For me, living the art life meant a dedication to painting, a complete dedication to it, making everything else secondary. That, I thought, is the only way you're going to get in deep and discover things. So anything that distracts from that path of discovery is not part of the art life, in that way of thinking. Really, the art life means a freedom, and it seems, I think, a hair selfish. But it doesn't have to be selfish, it just means that you need time. Bushnell Keeler, the father of my friend Toby, always had this expression, "If you want to get 1 hour of good painting in, you have to have 4 hours of uninterrupted time." And that's basically true. You don't just start painting, you have to sit for a while and get some kind of mental idea in order to go and make the right moves. And you need a whole bunch of materials at the ready. For example, you need to build framework stretchers for the canvas. It can take a long time just to prepare something to paint on. And then you go to work. The idea just needs to be enough to get you started, because for me, whatever follows is a process of action and reaction. It's always a process of building and then destroying. And then, out of this destruction, discovering a thing and building on it. Nature plays a huge part in it. Putting different materials together, like baking something in sunlight, or using one material that fights another material, causes its own organic reaction. Then it's a matter of sitting back and studying it, and studying it, and studying it, and suddenly you find you're leaping up out of your chair and going in and doing the next thing. That's action and reaction. But if you know you've got to be somewhere in a half hour, there's no way you can achieve that. So the art life means a freedom to have the time for the good things to happen. There's not always a lot of time for other things. A garden at night. So I was a painter. I painted and I went to art school. I had no interest in film. I would go to a film sometimes, but I really just wanted to paint. One day I was sitting in a big studio room at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. The room was divided into little cubicles. I was in my cubicle. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. and I had a painting going, which was of a garden at night. It had a lot of black with green plants emerging out of the darkness. All of a sudden, these plants started to move, and I heard a wind. I wasn't taking drugs. I thought, oh, how fantastic this is, and I began to wonder if film could be a way to make paintings move. At the end of each year, there was an experimental painting and sculpture contest. The year before, I had built something for the contest, and this time I thought, I'm going to do a moving painting. I built a sculptured screen, 6 feet by 8 feet, and projected a pretty crudely animated stop-motion film on it. It was called Six Men Getting Sick. I thought that was going to be the extent of my film career because this thing actually cost a fortune to make, $200. I simply can't afford to go down this road, I thought. But an older student saw the project and commissioned me to build one for his home. And that was what started the ball rolling. After that, I just kept getting green lights. Then little by little, or rather leap by leap, I fell in love with this medium. Curtains up. Know that all of nature is but a magic theater, that the Great Mother is the master magician, and that this whole world is peopled by her many parts. From the Upanishads. It's so magical, I don't know why, to go into a theater and have the lights go down. It's very quiet, and then the curtains start to open. Maybe they're red, and you go into a world. It's beautiful when it's a shared experience. It's still beautiful when you're at home and your theater's in front of you, though it's not quite as good. It's best on a big screen. That's the way to go into a world. Cinema. Cinema is a language. It can say things, big abstract things, and I love that about it. I'm not always good with words. Some people are poets and have a beautiful way of saying things with words, but cinema is its own language. And with it, you can say so many things because you've got time and sequences, you've got dialogue, you've got music, you've got sound effects, you have so many tools. And so you can express a feeling and a thought that can't be conveyed any other way. It's a magical medium. For me, it's so beautiful to think about these pictures and sounds flowing together in time and in sequence, making something that can be done only through cinema. It's not just words or music. It's a whole range of elements coming together and making something that didn't exist before. It's telling stories. It's devising a world, an experience that people cannot have unless they see that film. When I catch an idea for a film, I fall in love with the way cinema can express it. I like a story that holds abstractions, and that's what cinema can do. Interpretation. A film should stand on its own. It's absurd if a filmmaker needs to say what a film means in words. The world in the film is a created one, and people sometimes love going into that world. For them, that world is real. And if people find out certain things about how something was done, or how this means this, or this means that, the next time they see the film, these things enter into the experience. And then the film becomes different. I think it's so precious and important to maintain that world and not say certain things that could break the experience. You don't need anything outside of the work. There have been a lot of great books written, and the authors are long since dead, and you can't dig them up, but you've got that book, and a book can make you dream and make you think about things. People sometimes say they have trouble understanding a film, but I think they understand much more than they realize, because we're all blessed with intuition. We really have the gift of intuiting things. Someone might say, I don't understand music, but most people experience music emotionally and would agree that music is an abstraction. You don't need to put music into words right away. You just listen. Cinema is a lot like music. It can be very abstract, but people have a yearning to make intellectual sense of it, to put it right into words. And then when they can't do that, it feels frustrating. But they can come up with an explanation from within if they just allow it. If they started talking to their friends, soon they would see things, what something is and what something isn't, and they might agree with their friends or argue with their friends, but how could they agree or argue if they don't already know? The interesting thing is they really do know more than they think, and by voicing what they know, it becomes clearer. And when they see something, they could try to clarify that a little more and again go back and forth with a friend, and they would come to some conclusion, and that would be valid. The circle. I like the saying, "The world is as you are," and I think films are as you are. That's why, although the frames of a film are always the same number, in the same sequence, and with the same sounds, every screening is different. The difference is sometimes subtle, but it's there. It depends on the audience. There's a circle that goes from the audience to the film and back. Each person is looking and thinking and feeling and coming up with their own sense of things, and it's probably different from what I fell in love with. So you don't know how it's going to hit people, but if you thought about how it's going to hit people, or if it's going to hurt someone, or if it's going to do this or do that, then you'd have to stop making films. You just do these things that you fall in love with, and you never know what's going to happen. Ideas. An idea is a thought. It's a thought that holds more than you think it does when you receive it. But in that first moment, there is a spark. In a comic strip, if someone gets an idea, a light bulb goes on. It happens in an instant, just as in life. It would be great if the entire film came all at once, but it comes for me in fragments. The first fragment is like the Rosetta Stone. It's the piece of the puzzle that indicates the rest. It's a hopeful puzzle piece. In Blue Velvet, it was Red Lips, Green Lawns, and the song, Bobby Vinton's version of Blue Velvet. The next thing was an ear lying in a field, and that was it. You fall in love with the first idea, that little tiny piece, and once you've got that, the rest will come in time. Desire. Desire for an idea is like bait. When you're fishing, you have to have patience. You bait your hook and then you wait. The desire is the bait that pulls those fish in, those ideas. The beautiful thing is that when you catch one fish that you love, even if it's a little fish, a fragment of an idea, that fish will draw in other fish, and they'll hook onto it. Then you're on your way. Soon there are more and more and more fragments, and the whole thing emerges. But it starts with desire. Consciousness. Through meditation, one realizes the unbounded. That which is unbounded is happy. There is no happiness in the small. From the Upanishads. Little fish swim on the surface, but the big ones swim down below. If you can expand the container you're fishing in, your consciousness, you can catch bigger fish. Here's how it works. Inside every human being is an ocean of pure, vibrant consciousness. When you transcend in transcendental meditation, you dive down into that ocean of pure consciousness. You splash into it, and it's bliss. You can vibrate with this bliss. Experiencing pure consciousness enlivens it, expands it. It starts to unfold and grow. If you have a golf ball-sized consciousness, when you read a book, you'll have a golf ball-sized understanding. When you look out a window, a golf ball-sized awareness. When you wake up in the morning, a golf ball-sized wakefulness. And as you go about your day, a golf ball-sized inner happiness. But if you can expand that consciousness, make it grow, then when you read that book, you'll have more understanding. When you look out, more awareness. When you wake up, more wakefulness. And as you go about your day, more inner happiness. You can catch ideas at a deeper level, and creativity really flows. It makes life more like a fantastic game. Translating the idea. To me, every film, every project is an experiment. How do you translate this idea? How do you translate it so it goes from an idea to a film or to a chair? You've got this idea, and you can see it and hear it and feel it and know it. Now let's say you start cutting a piece of wood and it's just not exactly right. That makes you think more, so you can take off from that. You're now acting and reacting, so it's kind of an experiment to get it all to feel correct based on the original idea. When you meditate, that flow increases. Action and reaction go faster. You'll get an idea here, then you'll go there, and then there. It's like an improvisational dance. You'll just be zipping along, and you'll be banging on all eight cylinders. And it's not just a pretend thing. It's not a feel-good program when they tell you stop and smell the roses and your life will get better. It comes from within. It has to start from deep within and grow and grow and grow. Then things really change. So transcend, experience the self, pure consciousness, and watch what happens. Los Angeles. I came to Los Angeles from Philadelphia, where I had lived for 5 years attending art school. Philadelphia is known as the city of brotherly love, but when I was there, it was a hellhole. There wasn't a lot of love in that city. I arrived in L.A. at night, so it wasn't until the next morning when I stepped out of a small apartment on San Vicente Boulevard that I saw this light, and it thrilled my soul. I feel lucky to live with that light. I love Los Angeles. I know a lot of people go there and they just see a huge sprawl of sameness, but when you're there for a while, you realize that each section has its own mood. The golden age of cinema is still alive there, in the smell of jasmine at night and the beautiful weather. And the light is inspiring and energizing. Even with smog, there's something about that light that's not harsh, but bright and smooth. It fills me with a feeling that all possibilities are available. I don't know why. It's different from the light in other places. The light in Philadelphia, even in the summer, is not nearly as bright. It was the light that brought everybody to L.A. to make films in the early days. It's still a beautiful place. Eraserhead. Eraserhead is my most spiritual movie. No one understands when I say that, but it is. Eraserhead was growing in a certain way, and I didn't know what it meant. I was looking for a key to unlock what these sequences were saying. Of course, I understood some of it, but I didn't know the thing that just pulled it all together, and it was a struggle. So I got out my Bible and started reading, and one day I read a sentence, and I closed the Bible, because that was it. That was it. And then I saw the thing as a whole, and it fulfilled this vision for me 100%. I don't think I'll ever say what that sentence was. The pace of life. 50 years ago, people were saying, everything's speeding up. 20 years ago, they were still saying, everything's speeding up. It always seems that way, and it seems even more so now. It's crazy. When you watch a lot of TV and read a lot of magazines, it can seem like the whole world is passing you by. When I was making Eraserhead, which took 5 years to complete, I thought I was dead. I thought the world would be so different before it was over. I told myself, here I am, locked in this thing, and I can't finish it. The world is leaving me behind. I had stopped listening to music. I never watched TV anyway. I didn't want to hear stories about what was going on because hearing these things felt like dying. At one time, I actually thought of building a small figure of the character Henry, maybe 8 inches tall, and constructing a small set out of cardboard and just stop-motioning him through it and finishing it. That was the only way I could figure doing it because I didn't have any money. Then one night, my younger brother and my father sat me down in a kind of dark living room. My brother is very responsible, as is my father. They had a little chat with me. It almost broke my heart because they said I should get a job and forget Eraserhead. I had a little girl and I should be responsible and get a job. Well, I did get a job. I delivered the Wall Street Journal and I made $50 a week. I would save up enough to shoot a scene and eventually finish the whole thing. And I started meditating. Jack Nance, the actor who played Henry, waited 3 years for me, holding this thought of Henry, keeping it alive. There's a scene in which Jack's character is on one side of a door, and it wasn't until a year and a half later that we filmed him coming through the other side of the door. I wondered, how could this happen? How could it hang together for so long? But Jack waited and held the character. There's an expression, keep your eye on the donut, not on the hole. If you keep your eye on the donut and do your work, that's all you can control. You can't control any of what's out there outside yourself, but you can get inside and do the best you can do. The world isn't going to pass you by. There's no guarantee that meditation or delivering the Wall Street Journal is going to make you a success. But with focus and meditation, although the events of your outer life may stay the same, the way you go through these events changes and gets so much better. Yogis. When I first saw pictures in books of yogis sitting cross-legged in the woods in the forests of India, something would make me look twice. I'd notice their faces, and it wasn't the face of a man wasting time. It was the face of a man holding something that I not only wanted, but I didn't know about. I was drawn to it. There was such a presence of power and dignity and an absence of fear. Many of their countenances held playfulness or love or power and strength. That made me think that enlightenment must be something real, even though I didn't know what it was. I figured the only way to try for it was to start diving within and see what unfolded, because I knew that wasn't going to happen with life on the surface in L.A. Bob's Big Boy. I used to go to Bob's Big Boy restaurant just about every day from the mid-70s until the early 80s. I'd have a milkshake and sit and think. There's a safety in thinking in a diner. You can have your coffee or your milkshake, and you can go off into strange dark areas and always come back to the safety of the diner. The Angriest Dog in the World. The Angriest Dog in the World strip came about when I was working on Eraserhead. I drew a little dog, and it looked angry, and I started looking at it and thinking about it, and I wondered why it was angry. And then I did a 4-block strip with the dog never moving. 3 panels were set in the day, and 1 was at night, so there's a passage of time, but the dog never moves. And it struck me that it's the environment that's causing this anger. It's what's going on in the environment. He hears things coming from the house, or something happens on the other side of the fence, or some kind of weather condition. It finally boiled down more to what he hears from inside the house, and that seemed like an interesting concept, that it would be just balloons of dialogue from within the house with the dog outside, and what was said in the balloons might conjure a laugh. The LA Weekly wanted to publish it, so they published it for 9 years. After a couple of years, it was in the Baltimore Sun as well. Every Monday, I had to come up with what to say. Then I would phone it in. I wouldn't always do the lettering, and sometimes I didn't like the way the lettering looked, so toward the end, I did some of the lettering again. The editor who had taken on the cartoon went off to another paper partway through the run, and I had different editors. Toward the end of the 9 years, the same editor who had taken it on came back to the paper. And he asked me not to do it anymore. It had run its course. Music. I was listening to the radio one day when I was working on The Elephant Man, and I heard Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. I fell in love with this piece for the last scene of the film. I asked Jonathan Sanger, the producer, to get it, and he came back with 9 different records. I listened to them, and I said, no, that's not what I heard at all. All 9 were completely wrong, so we went out and bought more. Finally, I heard Andre Previn's version, and I said, that's it. It was composed of the same notes as the others, of course, but it was the way he did it. The music has to marry with the picture and enhance it. You can't just lob something in and think it's going to work, even if it's one of your all-time favorite songs. That piece of music may have nothing to do with the scene. When it marries, you can feel it. The thing jumps. A whole is greater than the sum of the parts kind of thing can happen. Intuition. Know that by knowing which everything is known. From the Upanishads. Life is filled with abstractions, and the only way we make heads or tails of it is through intuition. Intuition is seeing the solution, seeing it, knowing it. It's emotion and intellect going together. That's essential for the filmmaker. How do you get something to feel right? Everybody's got the same tools, the camera and the tapes and the world and actors. But in putting those parts together, there are differences. That's where intuition enters. Personally, I think intuition can be sharpened and expanded through meditation, diving into the self. There's an ocean of consciousness inside each of us, and it's an ocean of solutions. When you dive into that ocean, that consciousness, you enliven it. You don't dive for specific solutions. You dive to enliven that ocean of consciousness. Then your intuition grows and you have a way of solving those problems, knowing when it's not quite right and knowing a way to make it feel correct for you. That capacity grows and things go much more smoothly. The unified field. One unbounded ocean of consciousness became light, water, and matter, and the three became many. In this way, the whole universe was created as an unbounded ocean of consciousness ever unfolding within itself. From the Upanishads. The ocean of pure consciousness that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi talks about is also known by modern science as the unified field. When Maharishi first arrived in the United States in 1959, the unified field from quantum physics hadn't yet been discovered. So people would say, oh, that's baloney. They're looking for some field at the base of everything, but it doesn't really exist. No one knows if it's true. But then about 30 years ago, quantum physics discovered this field. They discovered it by going into matter, deeper and deeper and deeper, and one day there it was, the unified field. And then scientists like Dr. John Hagelin said that it's true. Every single thing that is a thing emerges from this field. So modern science and ancient science are coming together. Vedic science, the science of consciousness, studies the laws of nature, the constitution of the universe, and how it all unfolds. In Vedic science, this ocean of pure consciousness is called Atma, the self. Know thyself. Well, how? You don't know yourself by looking in a mirror. You don't know yourself by sitting down and having a talk with yourself. But it's there, within, within, within. Transcendental meditation is a simple, easy, effortless technique that allows any human being to dive within, to experience subtler levels of mind and intellect, and to enter this ocean of pure consciousness, the unified field, the self. It's not the intellectual understanding of the field, but the experiencing of it that does everything. You dive within, and by experiencing this field of pure consciousness, you enliven it. You unfold it. It grows. And the final outcome of this growth of consciousness is called enlightenment, which is the full potential for us all. The fourth state. Many people have already experienced transcending, but they may not realize it. It's an experience that you can have just before you go to sleep. You're awake, but you experience a sort of fall, and you maybe see some white light and get a little jolt of bliss, and you say, "Holy jumping George!" When you go from one state of consciousness to another, for instance, from waking to sleeping, you pass through a gap, and in that gap you can transcend. I picture it like a round white room that has yellow, red, and blue curtains covering the white wall. The curtains are three states of consciousness, waking, sleeping, and dreaming. But in the gap between each curtain, you can see the white of the absolute, the pure bliss consciousness. You can transcend in that little piece of white. Then you come to the next state of consciousness. The white room really is all around you all the time, even though the curtains cover most of it. So it's here, there, and everywhere. And sometimes, without knowing it or knowing how, people have transcended. With transcendental meditation, from the waking state of consciousness, you can experience that white wall anytime when you sit and meditate. That's the beautiful thing about it. Getting there. That Atma alone, that state of simplest form of awareness alone, is worthy of seeing, hearing, contemplating, and realizing. From the Upanishads. Some forms of meditation are just contemplation or concentration, and they'll keep you on the surface. You won't transcend, and you won't get that fourth state of consciousness, and you won't get that bliss. You'll stay on the surface. Relaxation techniques can take you a little way in. That's beautiful. It's like having a massage, but it's not transcending. Transcending is its own unique thing. When you dive within, the self is there, and true happiness is there. There's a pure, huge, unbounded ocean of it. It's bliss. Physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual happiness that starts growing from within. And all those things that used to kill you diminish. In the film business, there's so much pressure, there's so much room for anxiety and fear, but transcending makes life more like a game, a fantastic game. And creativity can really flow. It's an ocean of creativity. It's the same creativity that creates everything that is a thing. It's us. And why is it so easy? Because it's the nature of the mind. Because the mind wants to go to fields of greater happiness. It just naturally wants to go. And the deeper you go, the more there is of that until you hit 100% pure bliss. Transcendental meditation is the vehicle that takes you there. But it's that experiencing of the ocean of pure bliss consciousness that does everything. Modern science and ancient science. Scientifically, more and more is coming out to show that transcending is real and its benefits are real. By measuring EEG patterns in brain research, they can prove that someone is transcending. They can prove that the person is experiencing a fourth state of consciousness. I've seen this in live demonstrations traveling with neuroscientist Dr. Fred Travis. When you work on music, you use a certain part of your brain. When you talk, you use another part. When you sing, you use a different part. When you do mathematics, you use still another part. But if you want to use your full brain, you need to transcend. And then every time you transcend, you carry a little bit more of that transcendental consciousness as you work on your mathematic problems, as you sing, or what have you. Your brain is holding this coherence no matter what you do. It's a holistic experience. It's total brain functioning. And that increasingly becomes a permanent state the more you experience the unified field, the more that consciousness grows. It doesn't happen overnight, but it happens more and more each day. Vedic science has always said that this field is there and that you can experience it. And now modern science, with each step forward, is affirming that. Anywhere, anytime. You can meditate anywhere. You can meditate in an airport, at work, anywhere you happen to be. Usually I meditate in the morning before breakfast and in the evening before dinner. But when I'm shooting, I meditate before I go and again at lunch. And if I haven't meditated long enough, I'll meditate when I finish. I've been in places where there are no other meditators around, but it's very surprising. People kind of like it. I'll ask for a quiet room and they say, oh, yes, 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 I'll find you a very nice quiet place and protect you. And I go in and meditate away. We waste so much time in other things anyway. Once you add this and have a routine, it fits in very naturally. Identity. The thing about meditation is you become more and more you. Final cut. I love the French. They're the biggest film buffs and protectors of cinema in the world. They really look out for the filmmaker and the rights of the filmmaker, and they believe in Final Cut. I've been very lucky that I've been in with some French companies that have backed me. But it wasn't always that way. When I made Dune, I didn't have Final Cut. It was a huge, huge sadness because I felt I had sold out, and on top of that, the film was a failure at the box office. If you do what you believe in and have a failure, that's one thing. You can still live with yourself. But if you don't, it's like dying twice. It's very, very painful. It's totally absurd for filmmakers not to be able to make films the way they want to make them. But in this business, it's very common. I came from painting, and a painter has none of those worries. A painter paints a painting. No one comes in and says, you've got to change that blue. It's a joke to think that a film is going to mean anything if somebody else fiddles with it. If they give you the right to make the film, they owe you the right to make it the way you think it should be. The filmmaker should decide on every single element, every single word, every single sound, every single thing going down that highway through time. Otherwise, it won't hold together. The film may suck, but at least you made it suck on your own. So for me, Dune was a huge failure. I knew I was getting into trouble when I agreed not to have Final Cut. I was hoping it would work out, but it didn't. The end result is not what I wanted, and that's a sadness. Here's the thing, though. When you meditate, and bliss starts coming up inside, it is not as painful. You can ride through things like this and live through it, but it has killed a lot of people. It has made them not want to make a film again. Therapy. I went to a psychiatrist once. I was doing something that had become a pattern in my life, and I thought, well, I should go talk to a psychiatrist. When I got into the room, I asked him, do you think that this process could, in any way, damage my creativity? And he said, well, David, I have to be honest, it could. And I shook his hand and left. Dreams. I love dream logic. I just like the way dreams go, but I have hardly ever gotten ideas from dreams. I get more ideas from music or just walking around. On Blue Velvet, though, I was struggling with the script. I wrote 4 different drafts, and I had some problems with it near the end. Then one day, I was in an office, and I was supposed to go in and meet somebody in the next office. A secretary was there, and I asked her if I could have a piece of paper, because I suddenly remembered that the night before I had this dream. And there it was. There were 3 little elements that solved those problems. That's the only time that's happened. Angelo Badalamenti. I met Angelo Badalamenti on Blue Velvet, and since then he has composed music for all my films. He's like my brother. The way we work is, I like to sit next to him on the piano bench. I talk and Angelo plays. He plays my words. But sometimes he doesn't understand my words, so he plays very badly. Then I say, no, 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 Angelo, and I change my words a little bit, and he plays differently. And then I say, no, 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 Angelo, and I change my words. And somehow, through this process, he will catch something, and I'll say, that's it. And then he starts going with his magic down that correct path. It's so much fun. If Angelo lived next door to me, I'd like to do this every day, but he lives in New Jersey, and I live in Los Angeles. Sound. Sometimes you hear a piece of music, and it marries to a scene in the script. When I'm shooting, I will often play that piece of music in headphones while listening to the dialogue. Hearing the music is just a verification that things are going the right way. For instance, the right pace or lighting. It's just another tool to ensure that you're following the original idea and being true to it. So it's a good thing if you've got some music up front to play to see if the scene works. Sound is so important to the feel of a film. To get the right presence for a room, the right feel from the outside, or the right sounding dialogue is like playing a musical instrument. You have to do a lot of experimenting to get it just right. It usually happens after the film is cut, but I'm always trying to gather what I call firewood, so I have piles of things I can go to and see if they'll work. You just have to pop one sound in and you realize right away, oh, that is not working. Casting. It doesn't matter how wonderful an actor is, when you're casting, you have to pick the person who marries to that part, who can do that part. I don't ever give actors cold readings. I feel that's a torment for them, and I don't learn anything. Plus, then I would want to start rehearsing with them. It would take a long, long time to do that with every actor. So I just like to talk with them and look at them while they talk. I start running them through the script in my head as they're talking. Some of them go partway and then stop. Then one of them will go all the way through and I'll know. On Blue Velvet, I worked with the casting director, Joanna Ray, and we had all brought up Dennis Hopper. But everybody said, no, no, you can't work with Dennis. He's really in bad shape and you'll have nothing but trouble. So we continued looking for people. But one day, Dennis's agent called, and he said that Dennis was clean and sober and had already done another picture, and I could talk to that director to verify it. Then Dennis called and said, "I have to play Frank because I am Frank." That thrilled me and scared me. Sometimes I'll have somebody in mind from the beginning. There's a character in Mulholland Drive that worked that way. It was about 7:30 in the evening, and I was dictating to my assistant, this beautiful woman. And I started talking in a funny way. I started talking like the cowboy in Mulholland Drive. He just came walking out. I realized after I'd gone on for a while that my friend Monty Montgomery would be perfect for that. And he's not even an actor. Though he is an actor, really. He's a very great actor. But he married to that part. There are some actors I return to, Kyle MacLachlan, for instance. I like Kyle, and maybe he's a kind of alter ego. But the rule of thumb, obviously, is to get the right person for that role, and that's what you go for. So the thing is, even though Kyle is my friend, if he's not right for the part, unfortunately, he doesn't get that part. What's also really interesting is that when you work with somebody, you pick that person for a particular role, but then during lunch or something, you see another side of that person, and you remember that. So if there's another role that comes up and somebody says, "Well, Kyle couldn't do that," you may remember this side of him and say, "Yes, he could." Rehearsal. When you rehearse, it doesn't matter where you start. You get your actors together and you pick a scene that defines the characters in your mind. You have the rehearsal, and wherever it is, it is. The thing may be all over the place. Then you talk. Often the talking doesn't appear to make much sense, but it does to me and to whomever I'm talking with. You can feel it making sense, so the next time you rehearse, things may be a little closer, and closer still the next time. There's a lot of talking, especially at first. You can say many things, sometimes strange and stupid words, but you develop these little codes with certain actors or actresses. For me, for example, more wind means more mystery. It's a weird thing. Yet little by little, just by moving your hand or saying some word, a person says, okay. And actors, at a certain point in early rehearsals, catch on. Then they're rolling, and all their talent can go down the right track. The same holds with everyone you work with. When people say rehearsal, they're usually talking only about actors. But there's a rehearsal that goes on with all the people of the crew, in every department. The idea is to get everybody to come together and go down the same track, the track indicated by the ideas. So a prop man, for instance, may bring a bunch of props, and they're totally wrong. But you say a few things, and he says, "Oh, okay." And he comes back, and now he's much closer. And then you say a few more words, and then he goes back, and now he's bringing the perfect things. It's a matter of talking and action and reaction. It works the same way with all departments, because every element of the film is crucial if the whole is going to hold together. It's always the same kind of process. You start rehearsing, and it doesn't matter how far away things are. You just start, and you may say, "Oh my goodness, we're very far away." Prince, you say this internally, of course. End Prince. Then you start talking and rehearsing, and it begins getting closer and closer and closer. It's an abstract sort of thing, but everybody is getting there. The light bulb goes off at one point in each person, and they say, "I think I've got it." Then you have another rehearsal, and you don't want to kill the thing, so you leave it alone until you begin shooting. You're always thinking of that original idea, the mood, the character. And through talking, rehearsing, pretty soon it comes. And once everyone catches that drift, they're rolling down the line with you. And they're flowing with the things that were in the original idea. That's how it works. Fear. I hear stories about directors who scream at actors, or they trick them somehow to get a performance. And there are some people who try to run the whole business on fear. But I think this is such a joke. It's pathetic and stupid at the same time. When people are in fear, they don't want to go to work. So many people today have that feeling. Then the fear starts turning into hate, and they begin to hate going to work. Then the hate can turn into anger, and people can become angry at their boss and their work. If I ran my set with fear, I would get 1%, not 100% of what I get, and there would be no fun going down the road together. And it should be fun. in work and in life, we're all supposed to get along. We're supposed to have so much fun, like puppy dogs with our tails wagging. It's supposed to be great living. It's supposed to be fantastic. Instead of instilling fear, if a company offered a way for everyone in the business to dive within, to start expanding energy and intelligence, people would work overtime for free. They would be far more creative, and the company would just leap forward. This is the way it can be. It's not the way it is, but it could be that way so easily. All together now. When you work, you want a happy crew going down the road together. You need the ability to focus on things as a group. You need to concentrate on one thing at a time and not have a million different things distracting you. This capacity grows when people start meditating and diving within. There's an expression, where the attention is, that becomes lively. So when you focus on a thing, it's almost as if you start it moving and vibrating. You say, this is what we're going to do today. This is where we are, and this is what we want to accomplish. Then the work gets better, and the group gets happier. Twin Peaks. Ideas come along in the strangest way when you just pay attention. And sometimes things happen on the set that make you start dreaming. When we were shooting the pilot for Twin Peaks, we had a set dresser named Frank Silva. Frank was never destined to be in Twin Peaks, never in a million years. But we were shooting in Laura Palmer's home, and Frank was moving some furniture around in her room. I was in the hall underneath a fan, and a woman said, "Frank, don't move that dresser in front of the door like that. Don't lock yourself in the room." And this picture came to me of Frank in the room. I went running in and I asked Frank, "Are you an actor?" And he said, "Well, yes, I happen to be, because everyone in L.A. is an actor, and maybe everyone in the world." So I said, "Frank, you're going to be in this scene." We did a pan shot of the room, twice without Frank, and then one time with Frank frozen at the base of the bed. But I didn't know what it was for or what it meant. That evening, we went downstairs and we were shooting Laura Palmer's mother on the couch. She was lying there in sadness and torment. Suddenly, she sees something in her mind's eye and bolts upright, screaming. Sean, the camera operator, had to turn the wheels and follow her face as she bolted up, and it looked to me like he did a perfect job, so I said, "Cut. Perfect. Beautiful." And Sean said, "No, no, no, it's not." "What is it?" There was someone reflected in the mirror. Who was reflected in the mirror? Frank was reflected in the mirror. So things like this happen and make you start dreaming, and one thing leads to another, and if you let it, a whole other thing opens up. The continuing story. I love going into another world, and I love mysteries, so I don't really like to know very much ahead of time. I like the feeling of discovery. I think that's one of the great things about a continuing story, that you can go in and go deeper and deeper and deeper. You begin to feel the mystery and things start coming. The popularity of continuing stories on TV goes in waves. Periodically, the networks do these polls and they come up with different things. At one time, they had determined that people don't watch every single week. People may watch two times a month. And so the reasoning went, they lose their way in a continuing story and drop away from the show. Obviously, the networks don't want people to drop away, so for a certain period of time, they soured on a continuing story and wanted closed endings. I don't know quite how the network decided to let Twin Peaks become a pilot, but just because they let something become a pilot, it doesn't mean they're going to make it into a series. So it got that far, and even then, they didn't really know what to do with it. They send these things to a place, I think it's in Philadelphia, and they have people watch the shows and grade them. Somehow, it got a fairly good score, but not spectacular. I don't know what happened between that time and the time it aired, but it just got a huge, huge share that opening night. So that was a very lucky thing. The Red Room. One summer day, I was at a laboratory called Consolidated Film Industries in Los Angeles. We were editing the pilot for Twin Peaks and had finished